Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm here with Hannah Kent to talk about her new book, The Good People. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, The Good People takes place in Ireland of the 19th century, and the good people refer to these other people, so the fairies in Irish folklore. But just as today, people believe in certain things with a great certainty. In those times, you had a clash between the belief in fairies and a whole range of folklore and this Christianity that was there. What was it that drew you to the story about this particular woman, the effect of the clash of religions in 19th century Ireland, of all places? having done so well with burial rites in Iceland of a similar period, how did that all happen? Why are we going back with you into 19th century Ireland?
Well, I many years ago, when I was still researching burial rites, most of the things I had to do to even research that book incorporated translation, so which could be very tedious. About 98% of my sources were in Icelandic, so I'd spend a lot of hours just going through and very laboriously translating everything into English. And I remember one afternoon, I'd just become a bit bored, really, and I wanted to give myself the rest of the day off. And so I thought, well, look, why don't I read some old British newspapers to see if they had mentioned the events that I was researching, or the life of Agnes Magnus dotted, as they sometimes did with foreign executions and so forth. And so I was flipping through these old newspapers, and I didn't come across what I was looking for, but I did, just in going through the pages, find this extraordinary article, very brief, which detailed this trial which seemed to me quite extraordinary. This woman called Nance Roach, she was described as being of advanced age, of superannuated. She had been accused of a very serious crime. And it wasn't so much the crime that interested me, because of course I was going through a lot of criminal papers and records, but it was her defence. And she said that she had been trying to cure someone of an affliction of a supernatural kind. She was arguing that they were not human, but a fairy changeling. And it was this, really, this promise of being able to explore a whole world of folk tradition and fairy lore that really drew me in. And I remember I wrote the article down in my notebook, and many years later when I was asked about a second novel, I immediately thought back to old Nance Roach. And it was this this idea of being able to examine a faith that for many, many years was actually completely intertwined with Catholicism in Ireland. The two weren't really separate. Both the Catholic faith and the fairy faith and fairy lore were very much intertwined. It was part of the fabric of everyday life. But what I found extraordinary was at this particular time in Irish history, in the early 19th century, before the famine, you started to have that slow, painful separation of the various faiths, with the church sort of turning to parishioners and peasant communities and saying, look, you have to stop dancing at crossroads and keening at wakes, and you can't be going out and pouring milk at the foot of white thorns for the fairies anymore. And that was, you know, there was political impetus for that too. And I guess that's what really, really interested me in this particular story, because it happened just when these things had started to cease to happen, when that fairy faith was finally being sort of extricated from I guess, the broader faith or the broader attitude and belief in various sort of rituals.
I publicly accused you of being a time traveller on Twitter. sorry for that, because I started reading The Good People And I mean, I love reading history, and I love writing historical writing as well, historical fiction. And one of the things that struck me when I started reading this was just how well you convinced me of the reality of their reality, mm-hmm. these people. And when it's because it opens up with a very affecting scene with the death of a husband, and the normality of their experience and the way they're dealing with it gets broken by this priest walking in. And I had to sort of stop and think, when was she setting this? Because it seemed like that it jolted between medieval and modern in that priest walking in.
Yeah.
And then I started to realize that that's what I was seeing. I was seeing into the 19th century, this really old belief system. And it is the 19th century, so it is pretty modern. Like, you're thinking of Dickens and thinking of Byron and Jane Austen, as opposed to the medieval with all the Christian stories, and they're very different things. But here we have this collision. How do you go about convincing a reader like me that not only is it real and that these people are feeling it? Is it a trick of detail? Is it your own immersion in it? As a writer, I just went, how did she do that?
Well, look, first of all, you can call me a time traveller. I'd always take that as a compliment. I think for me, research was key, as it is for my writing, if not to provide material and details, but more to, I guess, set the parameters of my own imagination, so that I always feel that I'm working within a boundary of likelihood. I think what's so extraordinary about this time period, and I think there's significance in that all of this happened, this combination of very ancient, essentially pagan belief, and some amalgamation of that into Catholicism, but also the introduction of the new, and you know, the authority figures that we're familiar with even to today, you know, with the introduction of priests and judges and lawyers and courts and urban centres and the beginnings of industrialisation. That was very much how things were. What the famine did was really have the effect of decimating those old folk ways, with the destruction of a lot of the peasant classes, either through mass emigration or death or through sort of consignment to the workhouses. A lot of those old, a lot of the fairy faith and these old rituals and these old ways and storytelling, they belong to an oral culture. And it belonged to these particular kinds of people, so that when they died, this oral culture went with them. And so the second half of the 19th century is in many ways very, very different from that first half, where you still have the presence of these sort of ancient rituals and belief systems. For me, in terms of researching it, it was a really curious process, actually. Ireland, even though there aren't necessarily a lot of records, being a lot of these things having their origins in an oral culture, in the 1920s, in recognition of the slow disappearance of these old stories, there was a group of academics that were sent out into the countryside with pens and notebooks and bicycles to go and speak to the old people. It's incredible. And so there's now this amazing library of, like, it's a national folklore collection in Dublin.
Was Yeats involved in that?
I don't believe he was. He's not in this particular collecting of folklore, but he did go out and he collected a lot of stories with people like Lady Augusta Gregory, who were sort of a higher class, a literate class, and they would go out and they often heard stories through the people who might come and work at the big houses where they lived, the employees and so forth. And he would write those down, as did Lady Augusta. But in the 1920s, it was much more sort of seen as an official sort of government research program and as a documentation. And so I went to this library and this archive, and I spent a lot of time. It's like a fairyland, for pun badly intended, for the researcher, because you just have these walls of index cards and you pull them out, and one might be an account of a funeral in County Wicklow, and another thing might be a cure for warts. It's just all these various stories and cures written down. So I did draw a lot on what has been written, but also understanding that when anything is written down, something is neglected. And in the case of these men, primarily, who went out and spoke to, you know, various farmers, it was often men that they spoke to. So it's a certain kind of story and a certain kind of oral culture which has been captured, and there are certain stories which have been omitted. And also, this was a time when Ireland was very, you know, well, I wouldn't say comfortably Catholic, but certainly predominantly Catholic. Mm-hmm. So you don't, I guess, the pagan side of these things doesn't shine through as well as it perhaps ought to.
And your story is very much a story of women. There are three main characters, as Nora, is that how you...
Nora,
and her servant Mary and Nance.
Yes.
Are the three main characters, and all of them have different levels of belief. Yeah. And often, because Mary comes from a village a bit further away, has different versions of the same belief.
Yeah.
So even people who... you know, we would consider neighbours, have whole separate belief systems, or little changes that make, you know, I wouldn't do that for that. You know,
yeah, exactly.
It'd be something else. One thing that, when I first started reading Good People, the person who came into my mind was Thomas Hardy.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Thomas Hardy in a way, did what you're doing. It was talking about that period of change. So he had the mix of the pagan ways and the modernity crashing into age-old ways, and he was very eager to record that crossover. And there was drama in it, and you've created drama out of this in the same way, because the conflict creates a wonderful sense of drama in this book. One other thing that came to mind was there were two books that, although very different in their ways, Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude and Hampson's A Growth of the Soil.
Oh, yeah.
With that sense of going out in the wild and modernity catching up with mm-hmm. them. This feels like the point where modernity tapped them on the shoulder and said, I'm here.
Yeah, and this is what's so extraordinary about this time is that in the urban centres, in the townships, you had essentially modern life. You know, there were, shortly after these events, the time where the book set, you had the ordnance surveys. In fact, they might have already been beginning in the 1820s. And you had railway lines put down. It was, it was this incredible time of, I guess, the beginning of privileging of scientific rationality.
Mm.
And yet you'd go into these little valleys and these little nooks, and these things hadn't really changed over hundreds of years. It's funny that you mentioned both Hardy and Hampson particularly, because I really admire their work. And I did have several moments where I remember thinking of those final scenes in Tessa the D'Urbervilles, when she's in amongst the old standing stones, and Stonehenge, isn't it,
yeah,
right at the end?
Yeah.
And I think there's some sort of significant parallels there, not to sort of hold myself up to Hardy and Hampson. I don't think I could shine a light to them, but... yeah, certainly I've been influenced by writers such as that. And I think those same interests are ones that preoccupy me.
Well, for Burial Rites, and it didn't go to Iceland to write Burial Rites. He went as a student in exchange. But you heard the story of that is the basis for Burial Rites then. And then you went back and you had... What did you do for this book? Did you go to Ireland? Did you spend time in Ireland? Did you wander around? Or is this a purely imaginative approach?
It's both, really. I obviously first heard about this story when I came across the article, which probably was actually now about 5 years ago. So it has remained with me, I suppose, in a similar way that the story of Agnes Magna's daughter read, but probably in a less emotionally intense, less personal respect. In terms of going about researching this book, I was still travelling a lot with Burial Rites. So I started by just doing a lot of reading, trying to get a sense of how to enter this story, which I really knew very little about. I decided to try and get my hands on everything I could about the fairies, first of all, because I understood that this being what really compelled me to look at this subject for another book, this is what I'd need to know about. And I also was aware that, so I think sometimes we can regard fairies as kind of these twee, benign, bottom of the garden type English, Tinkerbell, right?
Yeah.
When I knew that for this book, should I be respectful to those old ways and those, I guess, that belief and that faith, which is still very real for a lot of people as well, I needed to know my stuff. And I needed to be able to get myself in a position where I could align or at least work out of a position of empathy for my characters so that however I was depicting them, I didn't make them just seem ignorant or stupid or, badly informed. So I did spend a lot of time reading fairy stories, both those recorded in the time that this book is set, but also contemporary fairy tales that have been collected, and also other things to colour, I suppose, and inform my understanding of how people lived. What were their houses like? What did they eat? What did they drink? What did they clothe themselves in? And then I did go to Ireland for about 6 weeks. And before I did that, I contacted a bunch of various academics and historians, museum curators, with the very vague hope that maybe two would get back to me and I could meet with them for an interview. And I was very fortunate, and perhaps it says something about the generosity of the Irish, that every single person wrote back to me and said, yeah, sure, come.
How
and
brilliant.
It was amazing. So I had these wonderful weeks of basically travelling around the country. I started in Dublin. There's the National Folklore Collection that I mentioned earlier, and I spent some time there and met with a few academics. And then I travelled west, and I drove all around the country, and I just worked my way down the west coast, stopping in at open-air museums. I find really useful, because even though you know that the recreated houses are often of a maybe the type of houses people lived in the second half of the 19th century, or from sort of a more wealthy families, you know, it's still something to go inside a building which is lime washed and see the thatch and see the, you know, blackened St. Bridget's crosses and smell the turf smoke. So it was, for me, it was very much a combination of trying to get this sort of a sensory impression, or at least a suggestion of what it would have been like, and also doing some more sort of scholarly research.
I am. Because one of the difficulties with research is you pile your brain full of this stuff and then sitting down trying to forget most of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because Nance doesn't know it all.
No.
And she's the wise one in this, who has the answers. And something that I admired was how you limited her perspective. So she doesn't have the photos of fairies that we know. She hasn't got the paintings. She hasn't got a sense of them. When she describes them, it's vague, necessarily vague. Mm. And there isn't all that, you know, noise, in a sense, of what it all means. And I've stepped in with her, and I was able to get rid of it all and just see it as she saw it, which then gave me the empathy and then gave me the sense of the kind of the rightness in her perspective, which is what great literature is all about, is trying to put yourself in another person's shoes and you know, give you that time just to say, my perspective is not always the right perspective, that other people have of you, and the person opposing me may be right in their perspective. So
absolutely,
that worked. If you want to
find, I'm so pleased to hear.
To my mind, that was so well done. Something that that jumps out because of the context that we're writing is that you're not writing about Australia.
Yeah,
and that in an Australian context is. You know, one of the things that people constantly go on about here in the Australian world is, you know, is it set in Australia? No, it's not. Oh,
yeah,
it's not set in Australia.
I know.
Oh, you've done it twice now, Iceland and Ireland, which kind of is means you're not up for the Miles Franklin because it doesn't have any reference. And yet that's one of our great gongs for Australian, great Australian writing. And to my mind, you're one of the great Australian writers writing now. And you can't get an award. Like, it's a strange thing. Was it that's where your imagination is? Was it an attempt to break free of the Australian context? What was it? Was it just...
I don't know. It's nothing really by design. I think I've just always been... I've just been interested in the stories I've been interested by. And I haven't ever really stopped to think of potential reception in terms of, maybe I need, you know, a latter-day scene in Australia. Maybe, you know, there's a relative of Nance's which has emigrated. So I can, you know, put myself up for the Miles Franklin. It's much more, I think, just having these ideas that won't let me go and feeling that I need to pursue the various, I don't know, I don't know. I think it's more just kind of pursuing what makes me curious and what makes me interested. And I don't actually think of myself as a less Australian writer for not writing about Australia. I don't think that I'm someone who, you know, will avoid writing about Australia. In fact, one of the novels I'm sort of circling around, I always have about five in my head at any given time, is set in Australia. It's something that I'm really interested in. I think the Miles Franklin is really great. I mean, it's wonderful to have awards full stop, and it's fantastic to have awards which specifically celebrate representations of Australia. I think it's a nation's identity, and the questioning of that identity and its continual evolvement comes down to a lot of storytelling, and that needs to be encouraged. And what's one of the great things that awards will do is that it will encourage people to question the Australian experience and to write about it and to interrogate it and to continually renew it. Sometimes it would be nice to sort of be eligible for those sorts of things, but it's not something I can say I lose a lot of sleep over. Yeah, who knows? Maybe one day I'll write that novel that I've been thinking about, have a different experience of it.
Now, with success, there comes the pressures.
Yeah.
So Barrow Writes was hugely successful and internationally successful as well. And then you've got the blank page and a contract. And when's book two coming, Anna? When's book two? I'm asking you a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
When's book two coming? As a bookseller, I'm kind of greedy, and I know a good thing. You've faced that. How did you get over? I mean, because a lot of people face that problem, and some people don't do it. I mean, there are a couple of names I could mention here, but I won't. You should know them. Who we're all waiting for another book from, and they haven't got around to doing it. How did you leap in? How did you get over that blank page?
It's a good question. I mean, you asked about it very politely. I had some people come up to me and be like, oh, second album syndrome. I just like, oh, you're making it worse. but I think, you know, it's a very real pressure. And I think it's hard to get back to that blank page and that place of play with its, I guess, the necessity of failure as well. You can't set out writing a book thinking you're going to get everything right the first time. And certainly, they're, for me, coming sort of back to that place, especially after quite a lot of time talking about what was essentially a finished book, I had forgotten just how terrible my first drafts are, and that can be really dispiriting. And so there was probably quite a short time where I did really feel the pressure, and there was some anxiety and trepidation related to that. But then I sort of gave myself a good talking to, as you need to, and I realised that to have the problem, and that's not the good word for it, but to regard it as a problem of having reader expectations, it's actually a wonderful problem to have, so much so that it's not a problem at all. It should be a source of gratitude. I mean, how extraordinary that there are people there waiting to spend time with something that you have created. That's a gift.
Yes.
You know, that's what you hope for. So when you, I guess it's, for me, it was a change of attitude, thinking of it less of, oh, I'm going to let people down, and you know, there's some people I won't be able to please them, and what am I going to do? I just had to sort of acknowledge, I said, of, you know, what a wonderful opportunity, first of all, and how wonderful that people want to read more of what I come up with. And secondly, you have to, I think, at any stage of writing a book, whether or not you've been published before or if, you know, only your mum's going to read it, I think to concern yourself too much with reception during composition is to hinder the creation of a work. So for me, I guess it was recognition of both those things. One, that actually I'm in an extraordinary position and I do have so much gratitude for being in that position, and I'll focus on that. And secondly, let's block out the white noise of, or any sort of possibility in the uncertainty of reception, and just get back to the reason why I write in the first place, which is because I love it and I love its difficulty. And I, you know, you need to embrace that, I think, if you ever want to complete a work, is to acknowledge that some of the beauty of writing is in its inherent challenge.
I'm very glad to be talking to you after so many good reviews have come out, because I second and third them, the reviews, and people who have been reading, good people here, are all very excited with the book. They loved it, and we're very happy to be able to hold it up and put it in on the front of our website, and to tell everyone to get a hold of a copy. And with that kind of reception, you know, there's a kind of a collective, I'm talking from the reader's perspective, a collective sigh of relief. Because we do, even readers put pressure on ourselves and on our favourite authors to do it again. And not only in this book have you done it again, I think that it is a better book than Berra Writes, to my mind.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so pleased to hear that. I mean, that was part of getting back to the love of writing for me, is that, you know, I still see Berra Writes very much as an apprenticeship for me as a writer. It was the first book I ever attempted as well. And similarly, this is only the second book that I've ever written. So I think I try not to, I guess, I see it more as a long-term thing of trying to continually develop and improve as a writer. So I'm thrilled when people prefer this book, because I hope, you know, the third book will be even better as well.
You've got the right publisher, because the Pam McMillan and Picador people do look after, and they see the long game.
Absolutely.
And that's a great thing of confidence to boost it to any author.
Exactly, to have that support and that patience and that kind of relationship, especially in our modern age where everything can sometimes be focused on just the product from product, rather than necessarily career or writing as a vocation. I'm so grateful for it. It's wonderful to have.
Anna Kent, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Anna Kent's book, Good People and Berra Writes, are both available on booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.